My name is Jim Carr. I'm the director of National Lutheran Campus Ministry, and this is the group that's going to be focusing for about the next 50 to 55 minutes on the challenge of protest, which is our topic for tonight under the overall theme of the challenge of the campus today. What I've been doing through the week is saying a few things about me, but indirectly. And the idea is that we can tell a lot about who we are by letting people know some of the significant people in our lives, significant others, and some of the places where we've been. So I've been using this as a technique to fill you in a little bit about me. I've had the opportunity to meet a number of you, and I've enjoyed the diversity that I found there and the great stories that you've had to tell. One of the things we do is begin with a story, a joke. We quoted a physician from Fordham University who did a little study, and he claims that people who laugh live longer. So this is our attempt to live a little longer. As it happened, there was a newly ordained pastor who was calling on one of his elderly parishioners, calling on her in her home. She was in her 80s, and she was very independent and prided herself in this. She was sprightly and in good health. She lived alone. And as this new pastor was visiting with his parishioner, there happened to be a bowl of peanuts sitting on the coffee table. And so he would grab a handful and eat them, and another handful and eat them. And as the visit went on, the peanut bowl went down, and he apologized profusely for how greedy he was, and he was so sorry that he'd eaten all those peanuts because the bowl was now half empty. And he said, "I'll just have to replace those peanuts for you." She says, "Oh no, Pastor, you don't have to do that. 80 years old with my teeth, I can't chew those peanuts anyway." In fact, she said, "I had a terrible time just sucking the chocolate off her." My story on Saturday morning is about another pastor. Now, a few things about some people who have been significant others in my life. Tonight I'd like to share just a little bit about two former students of mine, Dale Clem and Don Teeter. These were two Lutheran students when I was a campus pastor at Fresno State University in California. They were both radical students, but radical in different ways. Dale Clem was the chairman of the local resistance movement, which, as you may recall, in the Vietnam War period of our history, was a movement that opposed military conscription or the draft. Don, on the other hand, was a member of the local unit of the group called the Students for a Democratic Society. And this, along with the Weathermen, was perhaps one of the more radical groups on campus during the late 60s and 70s. Strangely enough, both were pre-enrolled at the seminary. Both intended to become pastors. Dale's father was a retired Marine colonel. And you can imagine the disruption in the family with the son resisting the draft. Mailing back his draft card, and then the government would send it back to him. Mailing it in again, and then they send it back. Finally, he burned his draft card at one of the rallies. The story of Dale is not particularly happy. Once the smoke settled, the Vietnam War was at least over in terms of being a hot war. Dale really didn't know what to do. He married, he and his wife had a couple of children. They moved up to the mountains, very much like the Cascades, only it happened to be in the Sierras. He was going to live off the land. He was going to live a simple lifestyle. His simpleness ended up in him contacting pneumonia, and he died. Great potential loss for the kingdom. Don had another story. Don, who was the member of the more radical student group, when he was a student, he was abducted in a robbery attempt. And the robber commandeered his car, and he was in a big chase scene, and Don tried to get the gun away from him. He was shot in the hand, and his picture was splashed on the newspapers as being a hero. Both of these two were protesters. Both protested out of their conscience and what they saw as things being wrong with their government and with society. And these two young Lutheran students taught me a great deal about protest. Places. One place which will help you understand who I am is the free speech area of Fresno State University. This was the scene of some very large rallies. 10,000 students jammed into a relatively confined area of the campus. And this was very much the theme of the day in the 70s, lots of protests. I learned some things from my days in the free speech area. I learned that whoever controlled the microphone had the power. Whoever had the mic had the power. This one particular day, there were many radical speakers, and they were saying some very radical things. Most were generously sprinkled with four-letter words. All were anti-establishment. They had a goal at that time. Since ROTC was on campus, they wanted it off campus. And since the president represented authority and he was not about to remove ROTC, he couldn't by law, land grant school, they wanted to get rid of the president. Lots of bad things being said about the president and about the dean of students, calling for their resignation. I spoke only once at these rallies, and this particular time, it just seemed to me that a little common sense needed to enter the scene. It was very much called for. I took the mic. I was preceded by a string of four-letter words by the previous speaker and suggested that the situation was almost impossible for the people, and that God calls us to have empathy for the people even though they weren't backing the cause, the particular cause that we happen to be backing. So I suggested that what they needed were not four-letter words, but our prayers. And so I invited 10,000 students to pray. The second place, which may help you to understand me and my odyssey, is a farm labor camp in Delray, California. I and two other young whippersnapper pastors were kind of pushing the South Pacific District of the American Lutheran Church to do some more meaningful ministry with Hispanics other than the Bible school programs that they were running. It seemed to us that there were some conditions that ought to be addressed rather than simply caring for the children of people who are working in the fields. And when I say children, I mean very small children, because they didn't have to be very old before they too were put in the fields. Part of the process and the tactic, as far as we were concerned, was to sensitize the district and church leadership to the problem of the farm workers. So we set up a matrix, which was a three-day live-in experiment where we had pastors and laypersons from congregations in the San Joaquin Valley, and the district president and two of his assistants living for 3 days in a farm labor camp, sleeping where the laborers slept, eating in the community kitchen where they ate, listening to lectures from leaders in the Hispanic community. In that whole process, I learned some things. I learned that protest, in and of itself, has a very limited usefulness. Out of that experiment came a $50,000 grant from American Lutheran Church. Out of it came a community center for youth in this small community in Del Rey, California, and some constructive programs and ministry that go on to this day. In this series on the challenge of the campus today, we've spent some time talking about challenge, and we've turned our attention to some of the challenges on campus today. The first session, we talked about the challenge of struggle. Then we talked about the challenge of ideas. We followed that with the challenge of identity. And tonight, we're going to examine yet another challenge on the campus, the challenge of protest. In a press release from the Lutheran Council, which was dated the 13th of June, I just received it in my office before we left Chicago to come to Holden. It carried the story of a protest demonstration that was reported in New York City at the South African consulate, and it involved 50 Lutherans. And many of my friends were in that protest group, and you may know some of these persons, and they may be your friends as well. Winnie and Ed May. Ed is the retired director of World Community for the Lutheran World Ministries, which is the USA committee of the Lutheran World Federation. Campus pastor Barbara Lundblad, who grew up in my hometown of Dolly, Iowa. She was much younger than I was, so I really can't say that I knew her in the growing up years. She's been a preacher on the Protestant Hour, along with John Van Orsdal. Bishops Harold Jansen, the ALC, Jim Grafe, the LCA, and Rudy Restmeyer, the AELC. Many of these folks were arrested at that protest. Now, why? Why should these church leaders march around the South African consulate carrying placards? Why would they do that? This is what Winnie May said. Since we know so many people in South Africa, we had to stand up and be counted. This is what Harold Jansen said. The South African government realizes there's a tremendous public outcry that has no other way of expressing itself. Barbara Lundblad said, I'm not saying this will do a lot of good, but it will do something for me. As a Christian person, I cannot stay silent about apartheid. The challenge of protest is a part of campus life today. A challenge for administrators who have an obligation to keep order and to uphold the law. A challenge for students as they wrestle with the issues involved and have to decide if protesting is an acceptable response for them. A challenge for everyone as we wrestle with the issues and as we wrestle with what God calls us to do in the face of these types of threats to human dignity. These types of threats very clearly evident in the apartheid issue, in the nuclear threat issue, in the acid rain and other ecological issues, in the abortion issue, the many, many crucial issues that you read about every day in your newspaper. On one day this spring, there were protest demonstrations at 60 different campuses across the land over primarily one issue, divestment and the root of that apartheid. Protest as a social action is not a new phenomenon. The Israelites protested their injustices to their Egyptian overlords, and you know what happened to their protest? They had to keep making bricks, but they took away the straw. Socrates protested the ruling 30. This was the government of Athens at that time, because he believed that it was tyrannical. And he believed that as a group governing the people, they were evil. And as you know, Socrates did not try to overthrow the government, but he refused to obey some of the government's laws. He lived in civil disobedience. He felt that there were simply things that he would not do as a human being and as a citizen. Martin Luther and his followers protested the sale of indulgences and other abuses in the church, and guess what name they were given? Protesters or
Protestants.
Protest is not a new phenomenon in the United States history either. All you have to recall is the Boston Tea Party, this colonial protest over unjust taxation. Or in 1919, the Veterans March on Washington, where all these veterans who couldn't find jobs and had virtually no pension or no benefits went and pitched tents on the Capitol Mall and said they weren't going to leave until their wishes were granted. And as you know, there were about 30 persons killed in that protest. Protests, it's just been so much a part of the American scene, from the rise of labor unions in this country, to the protests over child labor laws, protests over temperance issues, protests over women's suffrage. And in more recent history, the protests have centered on some things that are much fresher in our minds. The whole civil rights issue, the war in Vietnam, military conscription, the sanctuary movement. And these protests have involved massive numbers of people. Who can forget place names? I said people and places help to understand who we are. We learn a lot about one another. We just know where they've been and some of the people who were influential in their life. Can you remember these place names? Selma, Birmingham, Jackson, Washington, Chicago. You recall the photos of Martin Luther King and other black leaders as they faced vicious dogs, club-swinging mounted police, tear gas, and faced it with bleeding bodies? The civil rights protests were conducted in the spirit of nonviolence. It was the only way that government leaders and legislators could be influenced to change the laws. Martin Luther King had some models, not the least of whom was his Lord and Savior, but also Mohandas K. Gandhi. But nonviolence was the theme of the protest. And who can forget the names of campuses? Kent State, Berkeley, Jackson State, where protesters were beaten and shot as they demonstrated against U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia. The photos of docile protesters today appear regularly in the newspapers as they're being arrested for their opposition to all kinds of things, from nuclear weapons to ecologically destructive practices and laws to apartheid. Now, what is protest? What is it? Why do people protest? Implied in protest is that there is a greater power, and that power has control over laws which govern the society. And protest is viewed as perhaps the only way to draw public attention to those unjust laws and practices. Most protesters have already followed the acceptable avenues to effect change, and you know them. You can write to your representative, your congressperson, or to your senator. You can appear before the city fathers in City Hall. You can do all of these things. You can write letters to the editor of the newspapers. Most protesters have already followed these routes. And protest is often seen as a last nonviolent act to effect change. People with power either assign representative power, or people with the power of wealth tend to get their wishes fulfilled. It just happens that way. And those wishes are fulfilled either by force or legislation or manipulation. Protest is a tool of the people. It's the tool of persons with less power or perceived less power. an example. Let's go beyond our shores. Lech Walesa, the Polish labor movement. They're in a government which is basically dictatorial and authoritarian, and that government is not bothered by using force and intimidation to suppress the will of the people. And Walesa and Solidarity view protest as the only vehicle that they have. Protest and strikes are the only avenue open to them. You see, they know that force doesn't work. Force doesn't work. It doesn't work with any government, because force will be viewed as insurrection. It will be put down with a greater force. All you have to do is think of Hungary in 1948. Rather than protesting, what did they do? They tried to use force. And they were using pitchforks and bottles against tanks. And protesters know the use of force just doesn't work. Think of the Symbionese Liberation Front in California in 1974. They tried force. And every time you resort to force, the government will always come down with greater force. Why do people protest? Surely for many, many reasons, and we cannot outline them all at this time. But in my experience, when one considers Christians who protest, several answers seem to be very clear. First, they have a profound concern for human beings, a profound concern for their neighbor as Christ defined their neighbor, a profound concern for human dignity for all of God's children. They identify with the poor, with the dispossessed, with the suffering ones. And in their concern for justice, they add their voice to those who are seemingly voiceless and powerless. They make their disagreement known with words and nonviolent deeds, which do not make or result in injury to other persons, as far as that's possible. They're willing to accept the punishment of the law for their actions in view of the greater good and the human values which may result from their protest. And a clear example of this is the sanctuary movement, where Christians and congregations protest the unjust immigration laws while they protest at the same time as they are caring for refugees who are fleeing these life-threatening situations in their homelands. Helping those in need takes precedent in their view over outdated laws, which they know will eventually be changed. The challenge of protests on campus. James L. Fisher, who was college president in the 1960s and who's currently the president of the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education, wrote these words: "Today, with disagreement over divestment, national foreign policy, and other complex issues, campus presidents once again confront the question of how to handle protesters." I think the answer is clear. Preserve civil disobedience. To do this, however, we must enforce our laws without prejudice, and this is where we failed in the past. Now, Fisher makes a critical point when he writes that we must preserve civil disobedience and protest as avenues of action for those who are dispossessed, for the poor, for students in the student world. In a free and a democratic society, the voices of law and order and the voices of the majority and those in power have to be held in check. We call it preserving the rights of the minority. And this is so that the right of free speech and the right of assembly is protected. In this country, protesters are not rounded up, jailed, or disappeared, as is the case in many other countries. Our constitutional guarantees must be preserved, and that's what Fisher's talking about. And I believe he's correct in stating that the laws must be enforced. A college president can't not enforce the law. He must enforce the law as the chief executive officer of an institution, a college. But he says, without prejudice, that's the key. And he said, this has been the problem with protests in this country. Indiscriminate force and excessive force has too often marked the response of authority. I saw it in a demonstration when I was a campus pastor. A member of our campus council was standing on the sidelines with me, and a group of students had taken beds and garbage cans, and they blocked a state highway. The police came with the tactical squads, and my friends, that is no fun experience to see people running at you with these shields down over their face with great big long billy clubs, bopping people along the way. And they went selectively through the crowds because they already had photographed all the protesters and they knew the leadership. And the tactic was very simple. Don't arrest everybody, you can't. You don't have enough room in the jails if you isolate the leaders. And so they were running through the crowd, this tax squad, running down the leaders. And this campus council member standing next to me is cheering, saying, there goes what I'm getting. Can you imagine how I felt? The challenge of protest is a challenge to college administrators, but it's a challenge also to students. Students say, what shall I do? Is God calling me to stand up with these people, to add my voice in solidarity to this cause? Now, I don't believe many Americans are going to disagree with the right of people to protest. The challenge to students and to sensitive Christians is, do I have an obligation to protest? Not simply right, but an obligation to protest. That's what makes it so tough when you start wrestling with your conscience. What is God calling me to do? That's the question the Christian always must ask him or herself. What is God calling me to do in this situation? Stories told about Mohandas K. Gandhi, that he was visited in prison in Cape Town, South Africa, by one of his religious friends. And Gandhi had protested the laws which discriminated against blacks and coloreds. He'd been arrested, which became, as you know, a very regular feature of his life. And the friend asked Gandhi, well, why are you here? And Gandhi replied with a question, well, why are you not here? See, that's the question. What is God calling you to do? The challenge for all of us as Christians is, do we have an obligation? Do we have an obligation to stand up for the oppressed? To stand up for those who are wrongfully treated by unjust laws? You see, what are the appropriate actions for us? Since we are our brothers and our sisters' keeper, at least I think we believe that. Surely we'll work to have unjust laws changed in a normal legislative process. Responsible Christian citizenship demands this of us. But it's that haunting question, is this enough? Is this enough to let the hands on the clock spin and the pages of the calendar fly away? What is God asking us to do? We believe that God will provide guidance through something called the conscience. Now, we Lutherans should know something about the conscience. When Martin Luther, the protester, stood before the powerful Holy Roman Emperor Charles V at Worms, this is what he said. The thought is, it probably went something like this. Unless I am convinced by Holy Scripture and my conscience, I cannot and I will not recant my writings. Here I stand, I can do no other. God help me. You see, our conscience is to be our guide. And we must not be critical of brothers and sisters if their conscience leads them to do things differently than our conscience will lead us to do. Our respect for the conscience of each person is too great for us to condemn those simply who differ with us. Another form of protest is to publicly preach about injustice. Not many of us are willing to do that anymore. We don't very often stand on street corners or get in public places and do that kind of preaching. And we don't do it very often outside of the confines of our pulpits or small groups of sympathetic friends who just happen to think like we do, or in our homes. Amos, however, did use this form of protest. He stood on the street corners and before the rulers, and he preached about the evils of the grain exchange in Israel. The exchange was being manipulated behind the scenes by some wealthy, corrupt leaders so that the farmers who were marketing their products were robbed of fair prices. It was all done by manipulation. Amos delivered his prophecy at God's command, and this is what he told the people. And as a prophet, he's speaking for God. This is God speaking. I hate, I despise your feasts. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Your cereal and your burnt offerings I will not accept. Take away from me the noise of your songs, but let justice roll down like waters. Let righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. The challenge of protest has something to do with prophecy, and it has something to do with values. Not every protester is a prophet. That we have to get up front in neon flashing lights right off the bat. Not every protester is a prophet. Protest, however, becomes prophetic when it provokes the message of the prophets of old. That message seemed to be the same. Remember. Remember. Remember who you are. Remember who you are as people created in the image of God, but people who have become a broken image. You have sinned. You are sinners. You are capable of great evil. And when you do not listen to and when you do not obey the one true God, your sinful nature dominates your decisions and your actions. And the standard for God-pleasing words and deeds was set by Jesus the Christ. God alone can justify us, and God does this because of Christ. God also enables us to follow Christ's example as we are made holy by the Spirit's action in our lives. But remember, remember, this sanctification is a process, and you live in a world where evil seems to prevail. Believe in Christ, trust in God, and pray for the power to follow in Christ's steps. Protest has something to do with values because at its highest level of motivation, it becomes a course of action for justice for others. It was Bonhoeffer who called Christ the man for others. And Christian acts of protest are attempts, I believe, to do something for others, those for whom Christ died. The challenge of protest is very real, a very real part of academic life today. And we must empathize with students and other members of campus communities as they face this challenge. We're not exempt from this challenge either. See, we should be praying for God's guidance. We should pray for consciences honed and sharpened by our study of God's Word. I'm very willing to take your critique, your comments, and your criticism, but before we do that, to drive home the whole idea of the challenge of protest, we have the Holden Players who are going to give us a little role play, and then we will start our discussion about protest.
Well, but I think five chairs happened on the table. David, could you go down to role play is an improvised
situation in which the players take on the role or point of view of another person. We sat down for 1 hour and said, if we were in this situation, and we were each given a little outline of the character we were going to play. So if I was the dean of students, how would I react in this situation? So the players that you will see doing the role play tonight are not expressing their own viewpoints, and I really want to emphasize that. They are taking a role. So when you see them tomorrow, don't say, I didn't know you were such a Law and Order man. So we're all taking roles, and I'd like to introduce those that will be playing roles. This is Jean Swihart. She will be the college president for the evening. David Marek is on staff here, and he is the dean of students. John Paulson is the president of the student body of this institution. Jenna Bach is a student at the school, and I also am a student at the school. The scene is the president's office. Some students have occupied the office as a protest against apartheid, and we have spent the early morning hours in the office, and those of us that are occupying the office, why don't we just begin at that point? You think he's going to come in?
Well, they said that they were on their way. We're not going to give in now when they start giving us their line, are we?
No way of digging out, no.
Well, I'm a little worried about getting arrested. I really, really am. I mean, if I get a record, I mean, is that going to limit what I do in the future?
I mean, what's a record? I mean, what, you know, being arrested, I mean, this is great stuff. This is like, you know, heard about in the 60s, you know?
Well,
this is not what we need to hear now. I mean, we have to agree on this, and I'm really disappointed about your so-called Christian community, if that is how you...
Well, but it's this problem between law and love. I mean, I'm supposed to render unto Caesar, and I'm supposed to love my neighbor. Now, I think apartheid is wrong, and that's why I'm here. Okay, so don't hassle me, all right?
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to see you. And what can we do for you today?
Well, I think you are probably informed about why we're here.
Something about the school's investments, I believe.
Yes, about which we strongly disagree.
I see. In what regard?
Well, we are determined that that the policy of the college investing in South Africa must come to an end.
It's wrong. It's wrong, and we just have to stop it. You have to get rid of it.
And we won't leave here until something is done about it.
How do you feel about that, Dean?
I'm certain the students know exactly the way I feel about this. My position has not changed. The last time it happened, and it still remains the same, I feel this is totally against school policy, and I feel like I must remind you that as this is a business, and we must run it as such, you are... of course, here to get your education, and beyond that, you are here to spend your time as you please. However, when you are on campus, you behave as students, and if not, then we are, of course, forced to take the necessary action, whatever that may be.
We are not surprised that your view hasn't changed, that you didn't expect anything else, but that view is... totally unacceptable in this ambiguous view of your being understanding, sympathetic, and so on, and doing exactly the opposite as soon as you see your advantage.
Oh, let me try, if I may, to cover just a little middle ground here, perhaps between the two extreme positions.
Seems to me.
Well, our financial plan is very intricate and very necessary. I understand, for instance, that you're here on quite a large scholarship.
Well, that scholarship seems to be my only option for being here for studying.
That scholarship money comes from our investment plan and from the business people and alumni who help support us. Now, actually, this has gotten out of proportion. For instance, we're invested, yes, in General Motors, which is a good American company. Most
right, they make cars that fall apart after 2 years.
Well, that's not the issue. They're in South Africa. That's what we want to get rid of, General
yes,
Motors.
Yes, but you see, with a company that large, Exxon, General Motors, IBM, what they have in South Africa is minuscule. There's no way we can say to them, don't put any of this university's money in South Africa. It's a corporation. Everything works together. The few dollars that they have there are nothing compared to their total investment. Now, our financial planners stay within the law, both our law and the law of any country in which they invest.
If you say this is such a small amount, then what's the difference if you give it up?
Because the small amount of the company is invested in South Africa. We have large investments with the company as a whole, but most of that money supports jobs right here in the United States. Only a small part is spent in South Africa. And don't forget, if you close those plants down over there, you're hurting the very people you want to help.
Don't tell us that you're talking in terms of people and what is the good for the people. I hear you talk in terms of what the law says, what the organizations demand from us and so on. And I would like if we could talk in terms of what serves the people.
Well, of course, we have a Board of Regents to which I'm responsible. You're here giving me an ultimatum. I don't have control of where we put our money. The Board of Regents, the financial planners, if you want to make any changes, you have to go through channels, proper channels.
We've gone through channels before, and it doesn't seem to do much good.
Well, evidently they didn't feel that your protest then was valid.
Yes, what about the people in South Africa? It doesn't seem to me that they're seeing much validity in the protest of the people they're hurting either.
Well, on that side, the few dollars that we are putting in over there of the university's investments at least are keeping some of those very people fed.
Enough of this talk. I mean, let's get something accomplished here.
Well, I simply wanted you to understand there's more than one side to this question. My job as president is to keep this institution afloat.
And it won't be afloat if you've got students who are protesting and you get the media down here and things are going to blow wide open.
Well, it isn't going to float if we don't handle ourselves as good stewards either.
I'm going to stop the roll call right here. Our purpose was not to settle the issue. Our purpose was just to try to bring it to life in front of your eyes. And I think when we're talking about protests and a democracy, we're not talking about easy answers. So thank you for being our audience. And
okay, you've had a protest kind of approach from a couple of different angles, one in living color and one with a lot of words. Now it's your turn. Yes.
Hi. In discussing, I was born and raised in Fresno, so
oh.
I know the in the beginning, the image I've got of your definition of protest was civil disobedience. The protest wasn't protest until it got to civil disobedience. And secondly, from the role play, the first student was concerned about being arrested. In my contact with protest, there are levels, there are people that are letter writers. there are people that show up in mass, and there are, in organized protests, those people pre-decided, preordained, to be arrested. And there are those that are there specifically to handle any legal ramifications from that. So that's my only observation to those two things. If that question wouldn't have been a realistic question for her at the point that they were at.
Mm-hmm. We had just the same protest about 2 weeks ago at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And the students protested against the administration, and they did get the regents to agree, I think, to divest about 50% to reduce their amount of investments in South Africa, so it was effective.
That's, yes.
Oh, well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, talk about campus ministry. We have a small university in our town, but what role do you see the person doing campus ministry in the college or university having in all this? Do you see them as bringing issues to the forefront ground of discussion, to encourage protesting, or to back away from it? We kind of, in our church and university, are having some troubles with the role that the campus minister takes.
Would anyone else like to tackle that before I do?
It depends on the school. There are some schools that I'm fairly familiar with where the prophetic role is real important. It's real important to raise issues that people are not paying attention to. Sometimes it's really necessary to respond to students who are struggling with issues and have strong feelings about them, but need more leadership just in terms of learning how to learn more about those issues. I wanted to respond to what you said. At POU, which is the university that I'm the most familiar with right now, Dan Berrigan came to speak last year, and that raised a lot of eyebrows and a lot of other parts of bodies on the part of some people, just because of his name and his reputation. Many people found that offensive that he was even coming to speak to us at all. But one of the really meaningful things that he talked about was the process that they go through in his support group in preparing for doing some kind of protest. I mean, it's a lengthy process. And so, you know, somebody suddenly saying, I might get arrested, you know, on the eve of the thing. That's a question that they deal with all the way through. But it's certainly conceivable to me that students would find themselves in that kind of situation. The other university that I'm very familiar with is Columbia. And my goodness, students who were being trampled against the gates there by the police on horseback, I don't think they had Dan Berrigan there coaching them on how to go through a protest situation. So there's a wide range.
You could repeat the last words you had in your prepared statement, because ultimately it is a personal question of conscience on the part of the campus pastor, and I don't think you can give an answer. And whether, even as to whether or not you're called to coach or stand back or simply support your parishioners, who are the students, it's a...
Well, that's the posture that we've taken in National Lutheran Campus Ministry. We're not in the business of running protest schools where they're instructed in how you go through an arrest so that you don't get injured. We don't do that. It's basically the conscience of each campus pastor. But I think most campus staff would probably see their primary role as sensitization. In other words, trying to understand what the gospel means in the world in which we live. And when certain things just seem to jump out as being evil or demeaning whole populations, putting down the dignity of persons, I think they tend to see their role in that light, that it's trying to understand what the gospel means in these settings. And part of that, of course, is to understand and to study what in fact is happening in South Africa. part of it is to understand the whole scene of what divestment means. There are students and people who do all kinds of research, and they can give you chapter and verse on what corporations have what amount of money invested in what types of industries and businesses in South Africa, and what are the profits from this, and they can give you chapter and verse on that, and it becomes a responsibility of, I think, campus pastors to at least make that material available. I don't think it's a case of coaching. I think the word and a sharpened conscience is simply left on its own. And different decisions will be arrived at. Some will, we ask the question of obligation, the challenge. Do you have an obligation to protest? Given that protest is a nonviolent approach of people to affect change. A sociologist once told me about power. There are several forms that power takes. There's power in money. There's power in numbers. A lot of people have power. And there's power in ideas, information. If you know something that other people don't have, you have power. Now, I guess in terms of Christian persons, if you talk about the poor as being oppressed, or any segment of the world population being under the thumb of someone else, and that seems to be fairly clearly the case in South Africa, then numbers become important. But the snag, and we all know this, is the very thing that what's-his-face alluded to, Fisher alluded to. It's the prejudicial application of force or power. You read the stories out of South Africa, and for me, it turns my stomach. It's just bad, bad, bad. We saw much. Look at Kent State. Look at Jackson State. Look at Selma, Alabama. I mean, it's, I think Fisher has the key thing. But when we as Christians deal with that, there is power in numbers. There's a price that goes along with it. Some heads are going to be beaten in. Some, there will be bloodshed. It almost becomes a given when you talk about the human condition. The second thing that we have in our corner in terms of power is information or ideas. Seems to me that the gospel has something to say. I think if the whole Christian church could really mobilize in terms of taking seriously what it means to be a brother's and a sister's keeper, I think it could make a profound effect. In fact, I don't even think you have to have all that many doing it. Politicians and legislators are very sensitive to folks who vote. I think one of the learnings out of the protest movements of the late 60s and early 70s is that there is power in the vote. A young man by the name of Hayden is even into politics these days.
Yeah, I think also something that we need to work on is what Ed Schrader is working on, is relating faith to life.
Of course.
And that's something that we don't do, a lot of people don't do very well, is seeing, I can go to church, but where does that leave me, 9 to 5 or Monday through Friday?
Yes.
Something that bothers me. I mean, I don't have anything against protest, that's fine, but I'm from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Minneapolis Honeywell, of course, I know that they do some work for the war or for the Defense Department, but they have no trespassing signs. And the people, well, they've had a couple of them this year, but people have been, they ignore the no trespassing signs, and they go along as if they have not committed anything wrong. They go in there and trespass, get arrested. I think it's a big deal. That bothers me, because I feel that fine protest, but then don't break the law by crossing somebody's property when it says no trespassing.
Someone said to me, though, that it's when you get arrested that the news media pays attention. And I think that's the motivation for that. That it's a willful trying to be arrested so that there will be more attention brought to that situation.
Police Chief's wife always gets arrested quite a bit over Sperry Univac and also Honeywell. And yeah. That seems to make the headlines quite a bit.
Now, you can talk about thresholds, for example. We talk about thresholds of pain, and one of the tasks is to raise that threshold. Think about your own life. What is your threshold? At what point would you become a protester? I'm not going to ask about when would you take the law in your own hands and go out and get a gun or do some violent act. But when did you protest? You know, it's an acceptable part of the American scene. At what point do you change? Think back in history, the civil child labor laws. At what point do you finally say, enough is enough? I'm going to try and make somebody hear me. I'm just a little nobody, but doggone my conscience says I just can't stand back any longer. I've got to say something. What is your point? What is your threshold? Is it a case of your children being carted off and put in a uniform and basically becoming fodder as we had in the First World War in the trenches? Is that a point for protest? There weren't all that many protests in the First World War. What's your point? What's your threshold? Think about anything that's going on in society. What if it's a case of Social Security? What if the government reneges on its promises? And pretty soon you got a massive number for the elderly who just can't make it, and they had counted on this. At what point do you protest? Just think about your own threshold, and think about what you would do. Most of us, I think, would choose not to pick a violent course of action. But one avenue that is open to us is protest. I see the big hand is on 11, which means that we really have to bring down the curtain. I thank you for your very kind.